Succession, number 30493, reel 8.
One grey reel 8.
Yes. Toby, I have to say that I think these interviews are turning out to be a very strange experience. And I'm beginning to question the veracity of my replies, you see. You ask the questions, I'm determined to be as truthful as my memory allows. But parallel to the interviews, I'm recording on reel-to-reel my reading of diaries that I kept through the years 1942 to 45, which I'll be happy to contribute to the War Museum. Now, these almost daily entries cover every aspect of my life in the army and the activities of my regiment throughout the Middle East and the battles in Italy. But the words I'm reading, I wrote over 60 years ago. They have an immediacy and the ring of truth. However, they often conflict with my memory and the replies I give to your questions. Oh, isn't that interesting? Which I'm quite enjoying the complications. What do you think?
When you were writing the diaries, you were at the time presumably trying to be as
yes, I think I did my damnedest to just report it as it was. Definitely. I mean, there's some sequence where I'm on duty. We've got a fire plan. It requires us to fire all the way through the night, you see. So we're on, three of us on. It's possible to fire to a fire plan with just three on the gun. So you can have three blokes on, three off, three in there. Blankets, three of the gun, and you just worked to fire plan, which might be one shell every 10 minutes or half an hour, something like that. And so when I'd come off, I'd right in the middle of the night, I'd jot down in my diary what we've been doing or what was happening or how I felt about things. So it's really totally immediate, you know. Didn't go away and think about it for a week and then write it down.
There wasn't any particular sense of you editing yourself or.
I suppose in all anybody puts word to paper may engages in a sort of censorship, I suppose. But I don't. I think I was trying to be reported, as I say. I had this sense that I was chronically. What was happening to me in wartime? Simple as that.
You mentioned before that you had permission to take photographs, but did you have permission to have the diary as well?
Ah, now that's interesting because we weren't supposed to keep diaries. Obviously, you know, if the enemy gets a diary and says, and they're and you've chronicled all the effects of their shelling on us and the movement of our troops and how we reacted. The army wouldn't be too happy about that. So actually, almost the first thing I write, if I remember rightly, when we got into the fight in Italy, I write this intending, despite regulations, to keep it up to date, more or less. I write this as enemy shells moaning over our right flank, etc. Just in case this should ever fall into enemy hands, I must be careful to give no useful information away. So really, right from the day one, that's day five of that going into action, I wrote that down. So I was aware of, you know, having to be careful. I don't think really if I had been captured with my diary, I don't think it would have been a great use to the enemy somehow.
Was it known by the others in your unit that you kept a diary?
They must have seen me scribbling away. I just became, I adopted this persona. I became Joe Gray, and nothing I did surprised anybody because I was the odd bod, really, going around with a camera and jotting things out, doing odd drawings. I think everybody got used to me being sort of having my own way of life within the unit, As far as I remember, there we are. I may be wrong. But I think I was quite happy with how I was able to cope. It's one thing I left out. I'd say this question of boredom in the army, I brought in the photography, keeping the war diary, the bag of books I accumulated. The fourth thing was swimming. Really vital to my well-being, I would say perhaps to all the troops' well-being, that you could, every now and again, you'd find water, you could just splash in. It need only be 6 inches in a dwindling stream, But of course, very often it was marvellous sea swimming or river swimming in the river. Or sometimes it was just concrete tanks. Sometimes it was a proper swimming bath in a town. This is a tremendous booster of morale somehow. Being able to tear your clothes and uniform off. We didn't have swimming costumes, so you'd have all these 100 naked guys all leaping to the nearest water. Since the war, because I read Tolstoy's War and Peace. Now, that's a tremendous... You don't need ever to read about a book again about war. Tolstoy says it all, completely. The impact of war on individuals, families, towns, villages, nations, France and Italy. And Russia, locked in this terrible, terrible war. And of course, he'd been personally in the Crimean War, so he knew all about living under fire. And there's a wonderful passage where an officer, his troops are marching past this lake, and he looks at the lake, he looks at these men, all filthy and dirty, covered in dust, and he says, "Strip off in the water," and he gives this wonderful picture of the troops stripping off their worn uniforms, and the officer stares at all this naked flesh in the water, and he thinks soon it's going to be torn apart by shell fire and gunfire. There's this terrible image, and of course it happens. The men later on perish. The officer is terribly wounded, and it's a marvel. Everybody should read War and Peace. Put it on your reading list.
Was that something you dwelled on yourself?
Sorry?
The possibility of injury and
oh, death. I think every soldier, absolutely no doubt about it. No. It's hidden by all this bizarre humour that soldiers develop. It's extraordinary. I mean, you have to sort of be among it, in it, to discover the role of humour. It's why Spike Milligan's books, his war memoirs. Now, a lot of people have said this. Spike was in Italy when I was. He was a gunner too. He was badly injured. And his injuries spoiled his life. I mean, he had these terrible black, depressive moods that simply destroyed him when they happened, And yet he had all this marvellous bubbling humour. That's the public saw that image of the funniest man of all. And it was sprung from his army humour. if Reece Spike Milligan, now he's the other murderer, they're only two people who captured, I think, the nitty gritty of being a soldier in war. It's Tolstoy without any doubt whatsoever. Then there's Joseph Heller with Catch 22. It's all there. And then Spike Milligan, there's three books. You can throw away all the Hollywood films and the novels and the most of the memoirs. If you want to know what it's like to be a soldier in warfare, those are the three books, without a doubt. I mean, there's a chap called Paul Fussell. He's an academic professor of literature in America, who was in the war as an officer in the Second World War, as an officer. And he's now famous for this book, which tremendous criticism, tremendous approval, The Great War and Modern Memory. Paul Fussell. And he mentions Joe Heller's Second World War book. He says, the impressive emotion in Catch 22 is not black humour, the totally absurd, but horror. Whenever the book veers back to its primal scene, a bombardier's evisceration in a plane being smashed by flak, a scene given us directly and piteously, we recognise what makes Catch 22 disturbing. And he describes this marvellous passage out of Catch 22. Unforgettable. And it was done quite well in the film they made of it. He also wrote another book. He's written a dozen books on literature aspects of it. He wrote another book about this great war, Modern Memory, is the first great war, 1914. But he did a similar book about World War II. Both recommended.
How would the topic of each other's morale be addressed day to day within a unit?
Well, it depends on my diaries. I come across passages that events totally forgotten. I'm just amazed, you know. I'm describing the shells dropping around, how we used to have a sort of competition. When the shelling stopped, we'd all gather together and say, who had the one nearest to him, you know? And somebody's tent would be riddled by... the sorry thing is, we seem to be living in tents most of the time. I really, I can't believe it. But of course, we dug slitters, you know, slit trenches. And I find that we would dig one near the gun and then one near our tent. Or sometimes we'd have our own dugout. And you'd live in the dugout. But even then, you see, you'd have a tent over... When it rains so much, and it just, the sky is opened up and it just pissed down hour after hour, you did need a tent over your head. So there's this weird sort of bravado, I suppose, you know. I suppose there's an element of, you know, this machoism, you know, you have to pretend to be jokey and brave. Well, whereas you're sort of shitting yourself, to put it bluntly, just a moment before, you know. There are, just, as I say in the diaries, it's extraordinary. I'm reading about this bloke who describing how close the shell, and I'm going through such a strange experience, as I said. Nebelwerfers. Now, how is it possible for me, even 60 years later, to forget this terrible weapon that the Russians, I think the Russians developed it first. There was a rock, what did they call them, Katyushas, the Katyusha rocket. It's a terrifying sound. You know, you go, and then the rockets will come over and explode. And the Germans, they were Nebelwerfers. Nebelwerfers. Now I keep on about the Nebels and the Nebelwerfers. I have no memory in my head. How could I forget such experiences? I'll say the Nebels are active tonight, you know. I can hear that. We can hear them, the terrible roar on our left or our right, you know. And we're praying that they don't come in our direction. It's all that sort of written in the heat of the fighting, forgotten. It's ridiculous. I mean, look, I'm sure people in London during the Blitz, could they have wiped their memory of bombs falling down the street and house across the road being blown to smithereens and bits of bodies all hurling up and down the street? They couldn't possibly forget that, could they? Luckily, I don't think every Nebelwerfer ever hit us. It was always to be directed at the infantry or different parts of the front. But I'm still amazed to see it there in my handwriting all those years ago, but absolutely vacated from my memory. Extremely strange.
Were there ever any occasions you recall that someone was obviously breaking under the strain? How would the rest of the unit react?
No, it's extraordinary. The only time I ever saw a soldier break down out of stress wasn't because of any bombs or shells or machine gun fire. He was being punished. He's the only soldier I ever saw punished by this awful method called field punishment. And in the First World War, field punishment was horrific. You'd be tied to the wheel of a gun, and you'd be left there. I can't imagine the horror of that, really, in the First World War. In the Second World War, it was field punishment. You were loaded with all your equip, your rifle, and even your kit bag had to go on top of everything else. So in full battle order, so to speak. And you had to run. Now, we were the cause of this poor devil's punishment because we reported him. I mean, he was a product of a Glasgow slum. He was a chap who, you know, he'd really come from... You can imagine in the 30s what a Glasgow slum, bad enough today, but life in Glasgow in the tough areas, must have been beastly, horrible. And so he was a pretty sort of primitive sort of guy, socially, shall we say. And he happened to be in our tent, I think. There were six of us in the tent. And one day, one morning, we woke up, and he peed into somebody's mug. It was a mug full of piss. And, you know, the chap was outraged perfectly naturally. And it's just the kind of thing this socially inadequate guy would do. And, well, we reported him, but he wasn't very popular, I'm afraid. And so he was, that was his punishment. He had to, and he broke down, you see. There he was, going round and round. Actually, I went up to my officer. I said, "Excuse me, sir, I think, I've forgotten his name, I think what's his name has had enough, don't you?" And the officer said, of course, he said, "Oh, he must complete his punishment, you know." So the poor devil was sobbing his heart out, had to go round this parade ground, running. running and running and running until he dropped. Very unhappy, happy situation. Thank God it never happened again. Now, there again, and then under war conditions in Italy, I don't remember anybody cracking up. You know, some of our guys were really, I have to say it, brave men. You see, our unit was smashed up in the desert, and we joined the survivors, and the survivors have really been through it. And then the same men, for instance, there was a sergeant, Bob Hardiman. He was up there with the observation post, and also another guy, I've forgotten his name, who was a signaller. They were both survivors of the desert fighting. And there they were going up into the mountains, looking for observation posts with the officer. And as the mountains got steeper and steeper, more and more inhospitable, you couldn't get vehicles up, jeeps, anything. And the army, there's something else that people don't know about. We went back to medieval days, and mules. The army bought, I think, 1 million mules from Argentina and Cyprus and shipped them to Italy. How many people know that? And I've got photographs of Bob Hardiman and the signaller. It's a nice photo because Bob is standing back, scratching his head, thinking, and underneath I put, Bob Hardiman is saying, "Where the hell's it all going?" And they tried to load all their equipment onto this mule. And I've got photos of mule trains, you know, in the mountains. You know, at some point, all vehicles stopped. That was it. You just couldn't go any further. So the mules come in. And, you know, the courage of going off on a mule into these mountain tops to find some observation posts. Can you imagine? No, they were. Bob Hardiman got a medal because his officer was killed in the observation post and he took over. But a lot of blokes should have got medals and never did. They're really brave guys. No doubt about it. I can remember that anyway, if I've forgotten much else.
Going back to the chronology, what were your first impressions of Egypt as a country when you arrived there?
Now, anybody would tell you, first the heat, then the flies. The flies, my God, horrible. I mean, in the towns, in Cairo, of course, great efforts, you know, in restaurants and places to keep the place clear of flies. But out in the desert, I mean, somehow, how did they find us all those millions of flies? If you had a cuppa and, you know, something to eat, you're just covered in flies. You could let it be on your lips, you know. You couldn't eat without taking a mouthful of flies, almost. Horrible, horrible. Anybody. Next thing is lice. The lice were always a problem. I mean, you could sit on a cane chair, which was a great mistake because you had khaki trousers in the hot weather, and short trousers, that is, and the back of your legs would be just bare flesh, you see, which delighted the lice. You know, they're running around underneath the cane windings, you know, and they come out and have a lovely nibble, and you go out pretty soon you're in misery with all these bites all down the backs of your legs. And I remember having a holiday. I had a week's leave in Jerusalem, and very nice. The hospitality in in Palestine was excellent, you know. I mean, a lot of Jews realised that Hitler's men were just out there, not so far away, and we were there to stop them taking over Palestine. Imagine what horror would have followed. So they made us very welcome, and there were always good places to eat or to stay on leave in Palestine. But this one place, on the face of it, was spotless, but in the middle of the night, there were lights nibbling at you in bed. There's lovely sheets and spotless pillow, and the mattress, which were so lovely to lie in after blankets. And I complained that there were lights in the bed, and a guy came in with a blowtorch. And started blow-torching all the joints in the iron bedstead. That's what it was like. These are the sort of memories that you have of the Middle East. They're the first things that come to mind, I think. The discomfort. And another thing, every scratch, every pimple would become septic. I think I've still got a scar here somewhere. Just a sort of pimple which I might have scratched, immediately it's infected, and you go into the medical officer every day to have it dressed, and it gets worse and worse, and you can't use the arm. It's extraordinary. You really had to watch that you didn't get a wound infected. It was very difficult not to. So that's another thing, the liability to be infected very quickly if you're careless. So these are all sort of physical memories, you see, aren't they? Discomforts. Well, physical discomfort. You get used to it, but it's not enjoyable.
What provision was there for the hygiene?
Well, and don't forget, the arm is very good with medical... If you're sick. I mean, in Cyprus, I had a horrible experience. We were in barrack rooms, and in the centre of the barrack room is—I'm not sure I've told you this. No, perhaps I haven't. There was a stove which we keep feeding with timber, wood. And we would boil up water on it in a petrol can, a sort of 4-gallon can, I think it was, which you cut in half and used to boil water in. And the edges, of course, were still jagged, so they were quite dangerous things to have around. I just walked by. I was wearing just khaki shorts. My khaki shorts hooked onto hooked onto my shorts, and this 2 gallons of boiling water tipped down my leg and ran down into my boot. Now, I've never taken a boot off so quickly in my life, but by that time my ankle had been nicely boiled, and it's rather painful, you know. Anyway, I was rushed to the medical orderly. And happily gave me a shot of painkiller. And then pretty soon there was an army ambulance there. It was amazing. No, I'm probably just put in a jeep. I don't think I could have called up an ambulance. I don't know. This is in Cyprus. And I was rushed off to the Nicosia, where the army hospital was. And it took 6 whole weeks for that to heal up. But it was an interesting experience in my Cyprus diary. I was able to record all these other guys from different units. And it was fascinating because I had tales of the war from sailors, for men who'd been in the Middle East for donkey's years, who were on their way home, actually, It's quite an interesting diary, that one, I think. Although it's not so extensive as the proper war diaries, it does contain a lot of detailed information of what it was like to be a soldier on Cyprus in 1942. We were there to train in the mountains, of course. It was the 10th Indian Division. I'm not sure how much I've told you about that.